And near the top of page 349, the feeling of effort. I must now pass on to an analysis of the feeling of effort. I am very conscious of the brevity and somewhat dogmatic mode of my presentation here, but it is of course a very subtle and much discussed subject, as its problems lie at the heart of philosophy and psychology. I need only remind you of how it repeatedly turns up in discussions on personal identity and the will. Our knowledge of the external world and on causation and free will. Read that sentence again. I need only remind you of how repeatedly it turns up in discussions on personal identity and the will, our knowledge of the external world, and on causation and free will. To orient you, I will say that the main line I am following is laid out by William James, The Feeling of Effort, Gilbert Ryle, The Concept of Mind, Sartre, Being and Nothingness, and Paul Ricoeur, Freedom and Nature. So those are our references at the back of this article. It is first of all necessary to differentiate between the feeling of muscular exertion on effort and the will, or what William James calls mental effort. Differentiate between the feeling of muscular exertion on effort and the will, or what William James calls mental effort. The feeling of muscular effort is an aggregate of feeling coming primarily from the contraction of the muscles, stretching of tendons, skin, and any other parts of the body indirectly affected by the movement that takes place. So that the feeling of muscular effort is an aggregate. The consciousness of muscular exertion is therefore impossible without movement being exerted somewhere. Thus, if a person with paralysis tries to move his paralyzed limb, he may be conscious of making a strong muscular effort, and it will be found that he is making powerful muscular movements of the accessory muscles of movement. If he is prevented from moving these muscles, or if he is completely paralyzed, then he feels helpless and weak. He can have no sense of muscular exertion whatever. Now, what do we mean by the will or mental effort? I agree here with Ryle, who points out that there is no such thing as the will in the sense of a special faculty or immaterial organ by means of which, quote, the mind gets its ideas translated into facts. We do not have to perform special mental acts or volitions which somehow put our muscles into action. When we use such expressions as effort of will or strength of will, we mean to describe the person as behaving resolutely when in the execution of a difficult or disagreeable task. In exerting our will, we attend to a difficult object and hold it fast before the mind. A person who is weak-willed is easily distracted or disheartened. Strength of will, therefore, is directly related to attention. Attention is the essential phenomenon of will. Let us bring this analysis to bear on eye strain. As I said earlier, in normal seeing, we attend to the object in the world that we are looking at. The terminus of the act of looking is not in the eye, but in the world. I would remind you of the etymology of the word perceive. It comes from the Latin percipere, which means to notice, sense, to take hold or possession of something. In looking, it is as if we take hold of or capture the world of form that reveals itself to our eyes. Read that sentence again. In looking, it is as if we take hold of or capture the world of form that reveals itself to our eyes. But what happens if, for some reason or other, this, quote, grip on the visual world falters? One of three things. The person may turn away and either use some other sensory mode or turn his eyes to some other part of his visual world. Secondly, the person may exert his will and attend more resolutely to the way the object he is looking at appear. Thirdly, he may start making muscular efforts and start striving to see. It is this third alternative that leads to eye strain, so we must consider it further. So, once again, what happens if for some reason or other this grip on the visual world falters? One of three things. The person may turn away and either use some other sensory mode or turn his eyes to some other part of his visual world. Secondly, the person may exert his will and attend more resolutely to the way the objects he is looking at appear. Thirdly, he may start making muscular efforts and start striving to see. It is this third alternative that leads to eye strain. So we must consider it further. The feeling of muscular effort or striving to see appears when the person's attention, instead of traversing the body and eyes and terminating in the objects in the visual world, quote, flows back, unquote, to the organs concerned in the act of looking. So the person becomes conscious not only of the object he is looking at, but also of the organs with which he looks. This consciousness of the organs used in looking has severe consequences. It means that the person becomes aware of a part of his body as a resistance or an obstacle during the act of looking. As I have repeatedly emphasized, the body is normally translucent or docile during the act of looking, or for that matter, during any normal voluntary act. But in muscular effort, one becomes aware of part of one's body as a thing or an obstacle that somehow has to be moved. Another consequence is that the movement of the eye lose their essential meaning and become dissociated from their relation to the visual world. As I stated earlier, normally the eyes are spontaneously movable and are the means by which one's spontaneous active striving to relate oneself to the visual world are actualized. Thus, simply attending to the objects in the visual world and their movement is enough to produce the necessary muscular movement of accommodation and convergence to keep the object we are looking at in focus. Simply attending to objects in the visual world and their movement is enough to produce the necessary muscular movements of accommodation and convergence to keep the object we are looking at in focus. We do not have to be specifically conscious of our eyes or to try to move them in order to focus on things. How is the eye experienced when in the act of looking, our attention terminates in the eye instead of traversing it and terminating in the visual world? It is experienced as an optical instrument which has to be controlled from the outside. As I have said earlier, an instrument is outside the experience body and has to be controlled by means of the body, in contrast to the experience body itself, which moves spontaneously in relation to the world in which it is situated. But since the eye is not an optical instrument, attempts to control it as if it were will be futile. Hence the frowns and muscular tensions in the neck and head, which are seen in eye strain patients when they try to see. For in their attempt to force their eyes to see more clearly, there is an irradiation of muscular effort to the muscles surrounding the eye. This also helps us to understand why these patients feel they want to, quote, oil their eyes or dampen them with cool water. For this is an attempt to treat them as if they were an overheated instrument. And now we are at the top of page 351. Furthermore, it helps us understand the changes in the body image that so often occur in eye strain. These patients feel their eyes are out on stalks, quote, or somehow separated from the rest of their body, although they know that this is not objectively so, and of course there is no proptosis. The reason for this is that normally one feels at home in one's body and that it is one's own. But if part of the body is experienced as an instrument, then it will be felt to be separate from the rest. So that was a section from 349 to the top of 351, the feeling of effort.